Welcome. You're listening to the podcast of the Baha'is of Florida's Emerald Coast. I'm Ron Fraser. Tonight I'm talking to Alan Halm up in Minnesota and Joel Smith, who's here with me in Florida. We're talking about the evolution of religions, how religions change from the time that they start up to the present day. We'll look at some of the patterns that we see in the various religions. Alan, you want to start off giving us your ideas?
Yes. In my studies and readings of religions, I've come across something that I hadn't noticed before, and that is that each of the religions of the world has a beginning, middle, and end, and various stages in between that are not normally recognized. A lot of religion is looked at today as once established, the same for all eternity. But that does not seem to be the case. The Baha'is and also the Muslims, Christians, and Jews, to one degree or another, understand the idea of progressive revelation, at least to a limited fashion, that one religion leads to another. In other words, that implies that each religion has a set duration, what we call a dispensation, when a prophet or avatar or messiah appears. The spirit that they pour forth into the world has a set stage. And the first and most obvious stage is that the prophet reveals a set of laws and code of behavior and spiritual teachings that are valid in their full force for a certain time. But then the second part of the teachings refers to what will succeed or follow that religion. In other words, the covenant with the prophet to come. Moses anticipated the coming of Jesus, and we believe that Jesus anticipated the coming of the Comforter, Muhammad, and the prophets that followed him. With that in mind, we can see that at the very least there are two stages of religion, the period of fulfillment or of living the religion and its teachings, and then the fulfillment of that religion as it makes its transition into the new revelation. We might also see that for some reason there are other unpredictable stages of religion, such as what if the majority of a people in a certain religion don't recognize the teachings of the subsequent religion and their religion continues on. That's a sort of third stage of religion, a post-dispensation religion, we might say. There must be a reason for that occurrence, because most of the religions of the world, even the most ancient ones, are still with us. We have a great many religions, in fact. But anyway, the idea of what's to come, the prophecies of the end goal of a religion is very important to this concept and very interesting to me.
Is there something consistent that you see in these various religions, why they don't see, I'm not saying this very well, but they all have the expectation of some kind of an advent? And you say that there are a portion of each religion does not recognize the advent when it occurs. Is there some consistency in the reasons why these subsets of the religion don't recognize the advent?
I would say, again, from the history of religion, and again, I would have to specify this refers mostly to the world religions, the so-called primitive religions, i.e. native religions, they survive and continue to survive, and they don't necessarily adhere to these rules. So just that's my caveat, bear that in mind. But at any rate, with the world religions, I would say the reason why people don't recognize the subsequent revelation, there are two reasons. One that Baha'u'llah mentioned is that the clergy, and I don't mean to cast a negative light on the clergy, but the clergy eventually codified religion so that they became, in their old ages, somewhat static, and they made it so that people were incapable of, or it was difficult for them to see the subsequent revelation. There's also the element that God tests humanity when they're ready for these revelations. And so it's not an easy thing to accomplish. I mean, one can't just expect that there would be miracles and you'd have absolutely no doubt. There has to be some seeking and some desire to find a higher stage of awareness spiritually in the seeker. So naturally it's going to be difficult. At least that's the way I understand it. And I think there's evidence in the Baha'i writings that indicate that too.
In one of our earlier podcasts, Joel talked about the coming of Elijah that was supposed to precede Christ, that the Jews were expecting Elijah to come down from the heavens in a flaming chariot. And I guess that's an example of what you're talking about. If that had literally occurred, there wouldn't have been much of a problem with the Jews accepting Christ. But since that didn't occur, at least in a physical way, we and the Christians believe that it occurred in a spiritual way. But without that physical occurrence, it left a good percentage of the Jews not recognizing Christ as the Messiah.
I recall in Revelations, I'm paraphrasing badly, let those who have ears to hear and eyes to see, I think I reversed it, inverted it, hear what the Spirit says. And I think that was that what the biggest crux about all the religions are, is that if there were these miracles, who could possibly deny them? What choice would there be? And I think in the tablets of Baha'u'llah, I can't remember which one, Baha'u'llah talks about he could, if he chose, raise his voice like a lion in the wilderness, and no one would be able to resist him. But since he can't do that, because each person has to come and be able to see the message without being forced into understanding it. And the same has been true in every dispensation.
Joel, do you have some thoughts?
Oh, I have plenty of thoughts. One is the realization that there, as it says in the Baha'i writings, there are two different aspects of religion, that religion actually has a dual nature. One is the essential spiritual teachings of the Word of God. These are the eternal teachings that never change. And the second aspect of the dual nature of religion is that there are teachings and laws and ordinances which are temporary and non-essential and which do change. One of the problems that the people of different religions have with each other is that they focus more on the non-essential teachings of religion instead of focusing on the eternal spiritual teachings, the things that we all have in common. If you do this, not only will the religions not agree with each other, but actually the churches will not agree with each other. And that is why there are so many different churches, because each one has one little different thing that they think makes themselves unique over all the others. And there's a lot of hatred and disunity between the various churches, even within Christianity. So what the Baha'i faith says is that we should focus on what unites us, and to remove from the hearts of men the religious hatreds and which have chained them, and to bring all religions into agreement and unity.
Another thing that what you just said brings to mind is the attachment people have to their prophets and their teachers and their messiahs. It's probably one of the pitfalls of our dealings with religion is that the founders, the prophets, are such attractive personalities, and we become so attached to them that it's hard for us to... You have to get over that notion that you're giving them up and moving to another, and that's what a lot of people are afraid of. I recall when in Baha'u'llah's tablet to the Pope, I think it's to the Pope and not the Christians. Perhaps it's one of the two, in which he says, "Don't let a name debar you from recognizing me." In other words, because his name wasn't Jesus Christ, it's a disturbance to some people because they're so attached to him that they can't see his presence in a new name, even though the book of Revelation talks about a new name. To him who overcomes, I will give a new name, which will be written on a white stone, and only he who receives it will know it, something. Again, I'm paraphrasing badly again. I probably shouldn't do my scriptures this way, but I need to study a little bit more on them. But that's how I see it, and I think, again, there's evidence in the Baha'i writings to indicate that that just the attraction of the prophets is a distraction to people.
What do you think it is about human beings that makes them attached in that way? It seems to me a little bit like we probably all had the experience maybe in elementary school where we had maybe a second grade teacher or a third grade teacher that was just such a nice person that we really didn't want to go into the next grade. You know, we just wanted to stay there in the second grade and maybe do it again just because it was so nice being taught by that one person. And this next teacher, you know, we weren't really too sure about him or her. And so it was a little scary. I wonder if it isn't something like that little childish fear in us that makes us hesitate.
It reminds me of, I just forced myself to reread Goethe's Faust a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't read it since I was in college, and I think that addresses it right there. Human beings are afraid of change and yet are curious about it and unfulfilled without it. And the pact that Faust made with the devil, Mephistopheles, was that if he ever found a moment in which he said, I am content and I am satisfied, I don't need anything more, then at that moment the devil could take him off to hell. And, of course, Faust beat out the devil because no matter what the devil did for him, no matter how he tried to content him with the world, he was always unsatisfied and always yearning and seeking for something greater. So I think the answer is probably the tension between our curiosity and our instinctual desire to seek God, and yet our fear of change because the unknown makes a comfortable life uncomfortable.
So on the one hand, we have this desire to seek God, which is probably innate. I mean, I think that's why early man did cave paintings, and I mean, it seems to be really a part of every human society for there to be some kind of a reaching towards the divine. But then we have the fear of change. So those two things always in struggle.
I think so.
What are you thinking, Joel?
I think if you go back to the beginning, if you go back to the source, the origination, the original definition of the word religion, it comes from the Greek religio, which means to reconnect. A ligio is like a ligament in an arm or a leg, and what this is saying is that it is to reconnect us as people, as individuals, and that one of the fundamental purposes of religion is to unite people, to bring them together, to help them live in ways where others can relate to them in a positive way. If you look at Judaism in particular and Islam. Islam is very similar to Judaism. If you look at the code of laws that they have, the laws have certain specific functions. They not only teach the individual how to live a way that is healthy for him physically, it helps promote spiritual development, and then beyond that, in the community, it helps promote strong, unified communities. If you look at all the laws of the religions of God, this is the function of the teachings. We can argue about the differences all day long, but this is their purpose. One of the problems that people have is getting too hung up over these differences or what they perceive as differences. Much of religion today is tradition, and it's tradition based in man-made interpretations. And people are perfectly willing to argue with each other and to fight with each other over man-made traditions that really have no basis in anything. So I guess what the Baha'i viewpoint advocates is to try to look beyond the things that, primarily the superficial things that divide us, and to look at those things that unite us and bring us together, and to try to see that what the other guy is doing, even though he may belong to a different church or to a different religious organization, what he's trying to accomplish in his life is pretty much identical to what you are trying to accomplish in your life. And if you focus on these things, then there's a basis for a relationship, and there's a basis for a friendship, and beyond that, there's a basis for love.
That just reminds me of of restating the our understanding of progressive revelation, the idea that our religion is revealed in a given measure according to the time, the people, the culture, the place, and most importantly, the capacity. And I guess what's most interesting about religion, it promotes unity. It promoted unity in a small group in the beginning, but as the religion passed into its next phase, into its next dispensation, it asked its followers to stretch their spiritual imaginations to try and imagine a higher order of their own religion. And I think that is most easily possible now because of the fact that we're no longer tribes or small nations. We're literally a world civilization, whether we recognize it or not, with instant communication, as is evidenced by what we're doing now, and transportation. So our capacity is greater now than it was before, and we are now asked to stretch our imaginations and our spiritual imaginations to embrace the highest form of order, and that's planetary order and unified religion.
Something I like to tell people is the only reason you'll get kicked out of the Baha'i faith is for setting yourself up as an expert. We don't tolerate people who claim to have some special knowledge of what the writings mean. We seem to have really mandated a multiplicity of views. The scripture is the basis of our religion, but we don't attempt to have a single unified expression of what that means and to force everyone to conform to a certain interpretation. It's left up to each one of us to read and meditate on the writings each day and to allow God to inspire us in whatever way. So that's really a protection. These other religions have all seemed to fall into the trap of allowing people to set themselves up as experts and to gather a little group of people around them. And that little group of people is required to believe a certain way. Otherwise, they're sort of kicked out of that church and they have to go find another church where their beliefs conform. So it's interesting.
Let me address what you just said. Of course, one of the Baha'i teachings is unity and diversity, that we, as you said, we don't all have to believe exactly the same thing. There are certain unifying principles, certain core teachings which unite us, but we don't all have to be the same. And in a global community, this is essential, because culturally, the way people express the Baha'i faith is going to be very different from place to place. But there are, of course, certain basic core teachings which will always be the same. And if you can expand your vision a little bit to take in all of God's religions, each one is a little bit different. Each one is unique. Each one has its own particular focus. But if you can try to see what unites us, then you can function, as Alan says, as a global community. This also implies that Baha'is don't have to try to turn people of other religions into Baha'is. Of course, we do constantly try to teach and try to invite other people, but we don't view it as something that where the other person is unclean or stupid or unfit or something if they decide not to become Baha'is, that we can appreciate what they already have and to try to value that too. So in that sense, we don't try to force other people to become Baha'is. We don't try to force anybody to do anything. And this is difficult to achieve unity and diversity, but when you do it, when you have this viewpoint and you allow other people to be themselves, then what comes out of that is really something that is worth having.
I was just thinking about some readings I did about Islam. As we know, the interest in Islam has greatly increased for obvious reasons, and there's a lot of literature out there. And relating to what we just said, one of the relating to the notion that religions tend to become sort of stultified or or I promised I wouldn't use the word fossilized, but in some instances, we have the tendency to do that to our religion. And I say we because none of us are immune from that impulse. And there was one discussion by some Muslims as to why Islam needed reforming in current events, and they explained that in early Islam, up until the Middle Ages, there was a great deal of intellectual ferment, and they were virtually the leaders intellectually and scientifically in the world up until the beginning of the Renaissance, and then they slowly began to decline, and nobody could really understand where Islam went wrong. And these Muslims proposed that they tied themselves in knots through expertise. In other words, the experts in a religion that was not supposed to have clergy wound up having clergy, and these clergy decided to establish fact based on tradition and verifying tradition both logically and through scripture. And they, in the process of doing this around the beginning of the Renaissance, they seemed to have tied themselves in a closed knot. They couldn't get out of their own teachings. And it was not something that was inherent in Islam. It was inherent in human beings trying to tie down a spirit, trying to hold, I'm bending for an analogy here, something that can't be captured, trying to capture it and make it exact and put it under a microscope. And Islam wasn't the only religion that some of its followers attempted to do that to. It's happened to virtually all the religions. And I'm hoping and I think that the Baha'is have enough of an insight on into the nature of our religion that we can avoid that tendency and maintain the balance between individual interpretation and authorized interpretation and keep an open flow for a long time before we start having problems, if ever we will.
I have a question. Is there any basis in scripture for the clergy, either in Islam or Christianity? Or is this something that just was created by the clergy themselves?
My understanding is that clergy were authorized and inaugurated by the prophets up to Christianity. My understanding is that Islam was not to have had clergy, but they did. They developed an institution of the learned, if you will, and the institution of the learned hardened into positions of authority, and they became clergy. And it wasn't intended, but it happened.
That's what I suspected.
Well, I don't see anything in Christianity that speaks about clergy. Of course, in the writings of the Apostle Paul, he speaks of elders, but nothing even remotely close to what we have today. And of course, much of what the Catholic Church later developed is adopted from the Roman culture of the 3rd century.
I heard someone say that it was actually taken from the Roman army. The hierarchical structure of the Roman army was just overlaid onto the Catholic Church.
Well, it was. Emperor Diocletian was the one who set up the Roman administrative structure, and the Catholic Church later adopted that, and that's where you get the name diocese, comes from Diocletian.
Also, there is the fact that the chief priest of the Roman religion, it was, an appointed position that was highly sought after in Rome, and that was the chief priest, the Pontifex Maximus, and that is now one of the titles of the Pope. He's taken over. He assumed that title with the collapse of the institution in Roman society. So he still bears that title. And as far as scriptural basis for clergy, people go back and forth about it. Some people would argue that the giving the giving of the keys of heaven to Peter indicates his primacy. Well, Baha'u'llah affirms his primacy, but doesn't define what that primacy is. And that seems to have been one of the sources of division in the Catholic, in Christianity in general. It's, okay, so the Bishop of Rome has special status, but what is it, and what's the extent of that status? And so that seems to have been indicated as an institution. And the other institution were laying on of hands to the successors of the apostles. So that supposedly is the basis of the priesthood. And again, that can be argued. But pretty generally, Christians, I think, accepted the notion of spiritual descendants of the disciples and apostles, and that's where priesthood or ministership developed from. And it may or may not have been instituted.
I was in a discussion one time at one of the local churches, and they were talking about whether women should be ordained as ministers or whether women should be ordained as priests, and they were arguing that there is no scriptural basis for women not to be ordained as priests. And I told them that I didn't really have any problem with women being priests. My only question was, where does the idea of priest come from at all? Because it's a human invention. And as you said earlier, that's one of the barriers between people recognizing the new revelation when it comes. When the new prophet comes, always the people, the priests and the religious leaders of the former revelation oppose him and try to stop him.
On the most cynical side that I can think of, and I have to bring it up, one of the biggest reasons why priesthood in our belief are no longer needed, aside from the fact that we have to be responsible for our own salvation and our own knowledge, is the fact that once a priesthood gets comfortable and entrenched, they also get money, remuneration, and accolades for their knowledge and their wisdom. And so they tried in the past to outdo each other with greater sermons and would take fees for services, spiritual services, weddings, funerals, advice, whatever. And it seems that at least in Islam, one of the biggest obstacles to the acceptance of the Bab was his threat to the institution of the clergy as it stood. They were literally afraid that they were going to lose their respect and lose their livelihood. And so it may be a very cynical reason to reject the promised one, but that seems to be exactly what they did.
I was speaking with a friend of mine one time who is an associate minister at one of the local Baptist churches, and I asked him, I looked in the phone book and I counted, and there were 35 different Baptist churches in the phone book, and I asked him, why don't the Baptists get together, unify themselves? And you could do anything if you could do that. You could have churches, you could have schools, you could have hospitals, you could pretty much dictate who would be elected and all these different things. And he looked at me and kind of smiled sadly, and he says, this is these people's income. This is their business. This is their job. This is how they make a living. There's no way that they would ever agree to unite the different churches into one and to learn to cooperate. And I told him that, out of your own mouth comes your the greatest condemnation.
Well, that is interesting. It's a conversation I have with my employer. We've been, I won't mention her name, we've been friends since long before I was a Baha'i. We're best of friends. And she just recently became a Unitarian minister and went through a great deal of the Unitarians do their seminary through the Congregationalist Church because they're distant cousins, even though they're theologically quite different. And she is well aware of the teachings and the Baha'i faith regarding clergy, and she's still of a conviction that the quality of one's ministership and the purity of intention is still worth pursuing. And I think there's plenty of evidence from what Abdu'l-Bahá and Baha'u'lláh said about good clergy, good mullahs, good ministers, that they exist and that they would continue to shed their influence and that they're blessed. I guess the key to it is if they're not obstacles to the recognition of the Prophet. And that would probably be the only caveat.
I think one thing that it comes back to repeatedly, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, exists in every single one of the religions. And if people would only live that, if they would only learn to work together and to cooperate and to respect each other, then most of the problems that societies are facing today would disappear.
Well, again, it's a stretching of the spiritual imagination to imagine that everyone else is of our tribe and our family. And we can envision it, and a lot of people are partially there, but we still have to make that last effort. And that's what's getting the world into dilemma right now, I think.
I have a little dog here. She's a dachshund, and she just ferociously defends her yard. If anybody walks down the street, then she'll just bark at them and almost attack them. And to relate that to the various religions of the world...
Yeah.
I'm going to use that. I love that.
I've got a dachshund, too, so I know what you're talking about.
Speaking of dogs, my neighbor is a policeman, and he has a white police dog, an Alsatian, which he doesn't use on the job. And we always remark that if you walk close to the yard, he has this ferocious bark. But as soon as he gets up to you, it's all licking and wants you to pet him. It's just a ritual. So I think maybe... The police dog mentality is one we can emulate, at least this police dog. He's subsumed his bark and his ferocity. It's just a ritual now. And basically he's friendly with anybody and everybody, except squirrels, that's all.
So to bring us back to the original discussion that we started out with here, we were talking about the oneness of religion and trying to see the various religions in terms of the things that we have in common as opposed to the things that opposes people oppose. One of the really fascinating things about all of God's religions is that they all contain messianic prophecies. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, the Zoroastrian religion, and even the Native American religions all foretell the coming of a promised one, a man who is going to come, a great teacher who is going to appear and is going to profoundly change society and to basically unite humanity. Each of the founders of these great religions either promised to personally return himself, to send another like himself, or in some instances, the founder promised to do both. To come back himself and to send another like himself. Christians await the return of Christ and the coming of another comforter. The Jewish scriptures foretell the coming of another prophet like Moses and the return of Elijah from heaven. Many Muslims await the appearance of what they call Mahdi and Masi. Masi is the word that they use for Messiah. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita promised to personally return from age to age. Buddha said that he was not the first Buddha ever to appear, and that another supremely enlightened Buddha was still yet to come. Zoroastrian prophecies foretell the coming of a world renovator. Native American prophecies foretell the coming of a bearded white man from the East who will bring teachings which will restore the hope of unity. Now, each religion, in its own way, has foretold the coming of a great religion-restoring, world-uniting, peace-bringing Messiah. Now, for centuries, people from all over the world have been hoping and praying that they will be the generation which will witness the appearance of their promised one. Now, not many have considered the possibility that all these prophecies from the various religions might actually be foretelling the same event. Members of the Baha'i faith believe that in the middle of the last centuries, these prophecies actually were fulfilled and that the promised one truly did appear. Now, Baha'u'llah, the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith, claims to be the promised one whose coming was explicitly foretold not only in the Old and New Testaments, but also in the prophecies of the Hindu, Buddhist, Zoroastrian, Islamic, and the other religions. So this is what we invite people to do who are interested in the Baha'i faith and interested in Baha'i viewpoints is we ask them to do one thing. We ask them to gaze with an open and unbiased mind on the signs of his revelation, the proofs of his mission, and the tokens of his glory. We don't try to force them to do anything. We don't try to convert them. We just ask them to take a look and to see whether this might actually be true. So what are your viewpoints on this? What's your understanding of this?
I'd like to jump in here and just talk a little bit more about what Baha'is understand of prophecy. Baha'is consider themselves very fortunate to have a very potent and powerful tool for interpreting mystical and spiritual events like this. If we are to understand that in the person of Baha'u'llah, he has fulfilled all of the prophecies about the Promised One in one person, we need to understand that we need to see this with spiritual eyes and through spiritual metaphor. In Judaism, it spoke about this key that would someday be available, and it's in the book of Daniel, in which Daniel is asked. He asks about the book that is revealed, and it's a hidden book. It will not be revealed until the end of time. And Baha'u'llah has alluded to the fact that one of the early books he wrote is that book that unseals the sealed-up books in the Revelation of Daniel. And that book is called the Book of Certitude, or Kitab-e-Gan in Arabic. And in that, Baha'u'llah revealed the book in 3 days of talking. It illuminates how to interpret spiritually prophecies, scriptures, all these things, not just from a Muslim, Jewish, Christian aspect, but it can be applied in a larger frame of reference. And if a person has the patience, he can look at Buddhist sutras, Hindu sutras, Jaina sutras, all of them, and see in them prophecy and allusions to that one event. I could just refer to the Lotus Sutra. I read it many years ago and was very moved by some of the passages which seem to allude to our times. And it's been so long since I read it, I can't really talk about it, except that at one point it talked about the allegory of the burning house. The man who's in the burning house, is he going to accept enlightenment? Is he going to accept Buddha mind? Or is he going to stay in the burning house? He hasn't really got time to wait. He has to do what needs to be done right now. The urgency of the question is in his face at all times, like the burning of your house. And that's all that ever remained in my mind. But the whole sutra is full of allusions like that, and many of them, I believe, to the future times.
If we say that Christianity is a true religion and Islam is a true religion, and I think that Islam, I as a Christian, this hypothetical Christian, think that Islam is just the worst thing that ever happened on the planet, then I'm probably not going to be able to listen to the Baha'i faith with an open mind and a pure heart. So I guess the point I want to make is that to the people that are listening to this, is that you really have to have an open mind about these various other major world religions, and not just accept what your clergy may tell you. A good example, I hear this quite often from Christians, the idea that the Quran rejects the idea that Christ was the Son of God. And there is a verse in the Quran that you can quote out of context that will indicate that.
He begetteth not, nor is he begotten, and he is likened to none.
That's right. And the reason why that verse was revealed was because there were some people that thought that God had become a man and had physically gotten Mary pregnant. There's an entire chapter in the Quran, the book of Mary, the chapter of Mary, that talks about the virgin birth of Christ. So the reality of the Muslim belief about the relationship between Christ and God is identical to the Christian belief. It only becomes not identical when you argue about terminology. And when you take things out of context. And the Christian clergy seem to have been doing this for hundreds of years. So you really have to look at it for yourself with an open mind and look at some intelligent writing that's been done on the subject, and not just repeat what is essentially myths that have been propagated by Christians and Christian clergy and other lay Christians?
I would emphasize for those who are interested in how Baha'is understand these titles that the prophets have taken and the symbols surrounding their stations. Again, the Kitab-e-Gan is a wonderful book to read. In regards to that idea of the sonship of Jesus, which Baha'is uphold, it's a spiritual station, and each of the prophets has a title, or at least is understood to have a title. Abraham is in one sense the father of the multitude. That's what his name means. Baha'u'llah is the glory of God and the Father, the glory of God come in the Father. Jesus is the Son of God who comes with the authority of the Father. He's like a crown prince. And these are titles. How do I explain it? The prophets are all the same, but the power and the capacity that they reveal has a certain title or relationship to the other prophets. And a lot of this is explained and given light in the Kitab-e-Gan. It's like you said, I think it was you, Joel, who said there are plenty of reasons to fight if we nitpick about nuances. But if we understand the fluidity of metaphor and spiritual understanding, then these things melt away, and then the essential reality remains.
I heard of a Muslim group that argue, I guess two different Muslim groups argue over the direction your toes should be pointing when you pray. When you're kneeling down to pray, should your toes be pointing forward towards Mecca, or should they be pointing backwards away from Mecca? And for some reason, they decided that this was an important point.
The same thing happened in Judaism. Apparently, it happened in Islam. It was explained to me that there are four, maybe five schools of jurisprudence, of law in Islam, and they reached that point in the early Renaissance where they started fighting each other about fine points of observance, trying to outdo each other in the refinement of their observance. And one of the Baha'is who had gone to school in Iran, I had spoken to many years ago, she said that she was frequently ridiculed by the teacher, and especially in the class in Islam. She was forced to learn the Muslim prayers, which is no problem for a Baha'i. Why not? But he was always using her as a bad example. And one day he asked her to demonstrate the obligatory prayer, and she got down into the formal posture on the floor, and he said, "Get up, you've done it wrong." Typical Baha'i, you know. And excused her, and she went to him later and said, "What did I do wrong?" And he said, "Your feet were all wrong. The big toe is supposed to be pointing out, and the four remaining toes are to be pointed back." Well, now that's just that particular branch of Shia Islam. Well, in all fairness, I would like to separate crazy people from the religions they claim to espouse.
Well, as I said earlier in this presentation, the word religion means to reconnect. And so if what you have does not reconnect you with other people, then you might want to take a second look at what you have.
I think one of the fears that we have in this country, coming from the book 1984 and our experience in the Cold War, those of us that are a little bit older that remember it more vividly than younger folks do perhaps, is this concept of uniformity. In the book 1984, everyone was forced to conform to a very rigid and narrow standard. The idea of doing that in a religion is really bizarre to me. I try to imagine a God deciding whether or not to accept someone's prayer based on where their toes are pointing. You know, I just can't quite stretch my concept of God far enough to get around that kind of a God who would make those kinds of decisions.
Well, especially for we Baha'is, when we have revealed obligatory prayers and one of them has the, or two of them have the postures, but the postures are not clearly defined. So, and the Shoghi Effendi, the guardian, refused to define them any further. It's up to the individual how he wants to express what he understands these postures to be. And they're symbolic. They're not matters of salvation or damnation if you do them right or wrong. They're how to pray, that's all. And I guess in all fairness, again, about the extremes that religion can reach, I think it's healing for us to all remember that all religions are the religion of God. They are only piecemeal expressions of it according to our capacity. And anything that's wrong with those religions is us. It's what we tend to do if we lose our understanding of religion. And it's also one of the reasons why religion needs to be renewed, because we change and we grow. And we also, we humans, tend to corrupt our religions, and they need fixing up again.
There's a passage from the Baha'i writings I think kind of sums all this up. Abdu'l-Bahá in Paris Talks, page 51, said, quote, "The diversity in the human family should be the cause of love and harmony, as it is in music, where many different notes blend together in the making of a perfect chord. When you meet those whose opinions differ from your own, do not turn away your face from them. All are seeking truth, and there are many roads leading thereto. Truth has many aspects, but it remains always and forever one. Do not allow difference of opinion or diversity of thought to separate you from your fellow man, or to be the cause of dispute, hatred, and strife in your hearts. Rather, search diligently for the truth and make all men your friends." And this is my understanding of the purpose of religion.
Well, thanks, folks, for listening. We enjoyed it. We hope you did, too. I want to emphasize that all of this, except for that last quote, was just three guys talking. It's just our personal ideas, and none of that represents the official view of the Baha'is. So I encourage you to look at our blog for some links to some authentic sources where you can get the official view. So thanks for joining us, and remember, you're welcome to join us at any time. You've been listening to the podcast of the Baha'is of Florida's Emerald Coast. If you'd like to learn more about the Baha'i faith, the international site is baha'i.org. You'll find information about the faith, and there's also links to the Baha'i communities in several dozen countries around the world. Or check out our new blog at ecbp.blogspot.com. That's ecbp.blogspot.com. There's links to Baha'i websites and some great Baha'i podcasts. You can phone us if you want to talk to a human. Call 1-800-22-UNITE, or in Florida, call 850-543-2129. You can leave us a voicemail toll-free at 866-590-4545, or email us at panhandlebahais@aol.com. Thanks for listening.